transmitting live on 99.5 FM WBAI New York, Pacifica Radio for the tri-state area. This is Trump Watch, a weekly series investigating the actions of and reactions to President Donald J. Trump and his administration. I'm your host, Jesse Lent.
Conrad Tokyo, Sparrow Pistachio, just unnatural. Dog is off sabbatical. Rather watch.
We're not just having a conversation about school safety. You've had conversations, in all fairness. I'm pretty new on this job. We're here a little more than a year. I've been watching this stuff go on for 20 years. The president gets up, everybody's enthusiastic for the first couple of days, and it fades, fades, fades. Nothing ever gets done. We want to see if we can get it done. Let's get it done right. We really owe it to our country. I've been watching for a long time, seen a lot of words, and I've seen very little action. And you know, if you think about it, most of it's just common sense. It's not, do you love guns? Do you hate guns? It's common sense. It's all common sense. And some of the strongest advocates about what I'm saying are the strongest advocates, I know them very well, political people, the strongest advocates for the Second Amendment.
President Donald Trump striking a surprisingly conciliatory tone on gun control at the annual Conservative Political Action Conference, or CPAC, held in Oxon Hill, Maryland on Friday, in what was largely a divisive partisan speech reminiscent of one of his campaign rallies. The president was reacting to the public outcry following a school shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, on February 14th that killed 17 people and has prompted some of the surviving students to aggressively call on legislators to take action on gun control, several of them meeting with members of Congress earlier this week on Capitol Hill. The president also allotted time in his CPAC remarks, which lasted over an hour, to shift the blame to Democrats for their inability to find a compromise, as he describes it, on the Deferred Enrollment for Childhood Arrivals program, or DACA.
In 2017, our brave ICE officers arrested more than 100,000 criminal aliens who have committed tens of thousands of crimes. And believe me, these are great people. They cannot, the laws are just against us. They're against safety. They don't make sense. And you meet with Democrats, and they're always fighting for the criminal. They're not fighting for law-abiding citizens. They're always fighting for the criminal. Doesn't make sense. And by the way, the Senate Democrats and the House Democrats have totally abandoned DACA. They don't even talk to me about it. They have totally abandoned. You know, we get the reputation like DACA, it's not Republican. Well, let me tell you, it is Republican, because we want to do something about DACA, get it solved after all these years. The Democrats are being totally unresponsive. They don't want to do anything about DACA, I'm telling you. And it's very possible that DACA won't happen. And it's not because of the Republicans. It's because of the Democrats. And frankly, you better elect more Republicans, folks, or it'll never happen.
Hello and welcome to Trump Watch. I'm delighted to be back with you after a four-week pause for WBAI's winter fund drive. In an appearance on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert back in November, Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts said the presidency of Donald Trump should be measured in dog years, one for every seven. And though Warren is known to be no friend of the president, who's fond of referring to her as Pocahontas in response to the senator's claim of Native American ancestry, whatever your political leanings are, there's no denying that the relentless barrage of news emanating from the White House can make a day feel like a week. Considering this metric, it is a formidable task to tackle the seemingly unending stream of events that took place within the Trump administration during our February hiatus. Fortunately for all of us, we have the pleasure of being joined live tonight by one of the nation's foremost political analysts, national political reporter for The Washington Post, Robert Costa. Last April, Robert replaced legendary journalist Gwen Ifill as the host of Washington Week on PBS Friday nights after she passed away at the age of 61 from endometrial cancer. He's continued to helm the weekly show with the grace, tenacity, and fairness that Miss Eiffel made her trademark. Hello, Robert. Welcome to WBAI. Thank you so much for joining me.
Great to be with you.
Back in March of last year, you wrote an article entitled, "Hello, Bob. President Trump called my cell phone to say that the healthcare bill was dead." Your article describes the president in a surprisingly upbeat mood, considering he had just experienced his first major legislative defeat. What was going through your mind as the leader of the free world explained the reason for the bill's defeat to you on your cell?
What really stands out about that phone call, looking back, is the president's reflections on the Republican Party and on Congress. He came in as this outsider president. I had gotten to know him as a candidate even before he was a candidate for the presidency. And he saw the system as sick, the political system as something that needed to be reformed. But he wasn't an expert on the different ways it worked, on the jungle of political dynamics and factions inside of Congress. And when he really started to face it in the early days and months of his presidency, especially on health care, he encountered a system that he didn't really understand. He wanted to be change, but getting change done in Washington, as we all know, and as he learned, is very hard. And to hear him reflect on that and how the Republican Party's divisions crippled his effort, how Democrats stopped him along the way, you were hearing a president in real time experience and reveal what it's like to be a president, to be an outsider president.
You've interviewed the president numerous times since then. Is there anything that stood out to you in meeting him face-to-face that would surprise most people?
Well, what surprised most people, I think, about President Trump, based on my experiences reporting on him for years, is that a lot of people around him can get tightly wound, nervous, agitated by all the political tumult and turmoil. He can be thin-skinned, in particular about media coverage and things don't put him in a flattering light. At the same time, he is someone who has weathered so much in his life, financial trouble, personal and marital trouble, different kinds of ups and downs with his celebrity, that he really is able to weather turbulence in a way a lot of other people in Washington find abnormal. And I think back to my conversation with President then candidate Trump in October of 2016. I was the first person to speak to him on the record after that Access Hollywood tape broke. And he said to me then, "You don't know life. People don't understand. I've been through so much in life. This is nothing." He said, "I'm not going to quit the race." And so when people wonder, how can he go on right now, all the scandal, Russia? The thing is, I just think back to that conversation in October of 2016, and he thinks he's been through storms before, and he's lasted through them, and he'll survive this, whatever storm's in front of him right now. That's his perspective. That's how he is.
One subject I've heard you return to several times on Washington Week is how President Trump has changed the culture in D.C. To pose your own question back to you, what are some of the major ways you've observed Trump changing Washington culturally?
If you just look at what happened today when he had all these senators in there to talk about gun control, he has brought the television camera, that reality TV style, to national politics, to presidential politics in an unprecedented way. To now see these discussions play out in real time, he likes it that way. He canceled the press briefing today so he could have the cameras run and watch him. He likes to showcase governing, whereas in past presidencies, we've seen governing really be a private endeavor. With Trump, it's the opposite. We've also seen him change the culture in terms of the norms of the language and the discourse. And his combative, often inflammatory rhetoric has really come to define Washington in the Trump era, that people fight more publicly. They don't just grouse on background or have backbiting. Of course, that still exists very much in Washington. But there's a lot more just if people are having spats, they have them publicly. And it's in a way, it's made Washington almost more old school in the way it was in the early 20th century, the 19th century, where politics was a rougher game. Politics, I think, post-World War II has become much more packaged, especially in the 80s and 90s with the rise of the soundbite. But now Trump has kind of brought it back to that rough and tumble way.
Do you have any sense of how many of these changes are to stay, or at least for the foreseeable future, or how many will be ushered out when Trump's presidency comes to an end?
It's hard to say, but it could be the latter, with a lot of it being ushered out. Trump has transformed the political culture in injecting this nationalism, populism, some would say, racially inflamed aspects of politics into Washington and the way it works. But there's a real hunger in Washington in aspects of the press corps in both the Democratic and Republican parties to return to a norm at some point, that Trump is a revelation about what's happening in the country, the grievances about the global economy, a lot of the anger about the political system. But you sense that Washington is not really ready to change as much as Trump wants it to change. And so often when you talk to lawmakers, Republicans and Democrats, they really operate by the old rules, not by the Trump rules. They know they have to adjust right now. But you don't see Washington saying, let's now just have this kind of reality-style political system. People still, like Mitch McConnell, the majority leader, Speaker Paul Ryan, they're traditional politicians. So are Leader Pelosi and Leader Schumer on the Democratic side.
The students of Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, returned to class earlier today for the first time following the February 14th shooting. President Trump was very conciliatory in his comments to CPAC on Friday, calling for something to be done, unlike former administrations. Do you believe that the cultural moment we're experiencing right now will lead to substantial legislative action on gun control?
Based on my reporting, it will. The substantial, we'll have to see what that means. President Trump is articulating publicly that he wants to move on background checks, but the appetite in the Republican-controlled Congress is not really there for sweeping things. You see the Manchin-Toomey background check bill being talked about by both parties, but really what they're looking at this moment are more narrow legislative items on background checks to fix certain reporting systems for background checks. They're not looking at outlawing semi-automatic weapons like the AR-15. What's really going to be a factor in gun control debate is how it plays out now, what gets done incrementally in the coming months. But then what happens after the midterm elections? If the Democrats take back the House or even the Senate, I think you'll certainly see them move on gun control in a way you won't with the Republican Congress. But gun control is, I think, as much as it's going to be an issue in Congress right now, it will be certainly on the ballot in a sense this fall. Suburban voters especially are talking about this issue more and more in the wake of this horrific shooting.
To jump to another topic brought up in Trump's speech from Friday, DACA recipients continue to exist in limbo, with the Supreme Court declining to take up a DACA case before it was ruled on by the appeals court on Monday. Where do you see the political fight over DACA heading? And again, for our listeners, these are the quote-unquote dreamers brought to the U.S. as children by parents who are undocumented immigrants.
President Trump says he wants to find a solution, but he also wants to have his border wall. And as long as that's on the table as something that's necessary as part of a deal, you're really going to see an impasse continue. You could have the government move in some kind of non-legislative way to come up with a fix or do some kind of short-term extension as the March deadline approaches about this month, about in the coming month, what they're going to do with DACA recipients. Both parties don't want to see DACA people be out there on a limb ahead of the midterm elections. They know it's bad politics, but they're all trying to navigate a deal here. Who's going to get what in exchange for a DACA extension or a DACA protection? But I don't think you're going to see deportations. It does not seem like we're moving in that direction, but we are at a political standstill.
I'm speaking with Robert Costa, the host of Washington Week on PBS. You're listening to Trump Watch on WBAI New York. I'm Jesse Lent. Robert, there seems to be a technique being employed by Republicans in the Senate, which moves forward with policies that Democrats are passionate about, such as a fix for DACA or stepping up background checks. But each bill includes a sort of poison pill that most Democrats could never support without facing major blowback from their constituents. One example of this would be the immigration bill put forth by Senator Jeff Flake of Arizona earlier this month, which would, as reported by Vox, provide a pathway to citizenship for more than 2 million young unauthorized immigrants, but would also provide $2.5 billion for Trump's pledge of a border wall between the U.S. and Mexico, and eliminate the diversity lottery. as well as preventing DACA recipients from sponsoring their parents for legal status. And then there's a bipartisan bill to improve background checks, a bipartisan bill authored by Republican Senator John Cornyn of Texas and Democrat Chris Murphy of Connecticut that, as Politico describes, would allow individuals who hold a concealed carry weapons permit in one state to take their firearm across state lines. Is this just the way that sausage gets made in Washington, so to speak? Or are the Republicans actually looking for political cover on controversial issues like DACA and gun control and believe they can get it from these kind of too flawed to pass efforts?
They do look to the states for cues about what's going to be politically possible. And this stuff all matters in politics. Politics is more nuanced, and it's more of an art sometimes than a science. And you see Republicans in Washington looking at what's happening in Florida with Governor Scott, who has an A-plus NRA rating. He's now moving on gun control, working with the Republican state legislature to come up with some policies. If those continue to move forward and to be successful in Florida in a Republican state in a swing year, that could help encourage national lawmakers to say, hey, we're Republicans, we love the NRA, but maybe we're going to move forward on a few of these bills. Maybe there's more to be done. And both parties see it as a protective measure politically, not just about protecting the schools, of course, which is paramount, but protecting themselves politically in the sense that Democrats, of course, need to tell their base that they're succeeding on gun control. And Republicans say, if this is going to be a rough year for us, maybe we do something on gun control right now. What can we tolerate politically so we don't alienate the Republican base ahead of the crucial midterms, but also make sure we keep those swing suburban mothers and fathers who are concerned about gun control in schools? How do we make sure they come out for Republicans as well? It's all political calculation. It's a policy calculation. That's why we love politics. It's complicated.
I wanted to get to a couple stories breaking this week. You were on the PBS NewsHour yesterday to discuss your reporting on senior advisor to the president, Jared Kushner, getting his security clearance lowered from top secret to secret in an effort by White House Chief of Staff John Kelly to resolve staff who only had received interim security clearances in the wake of the Rob Porter fiasco. How do you think Kushner's security demotion will affect the president directly?
In what way in particular are you interested in on that?
Yeah, well, we know that that he is very close to Trump, also being his son-in-law. Does Kushner and his role at the White House has been very widely defined, from working with Mexico to seeking some kind of agreement between the Israelis and Palestinians. Do you think that Kushner's security demotion, I'm asking, would affect Trump's agenda in any significant way?
Not really, because Jared's more of an ambassador for the administration. He's someone who works as an ambassador of sorts on the Mexico wall issue, who works with Israel on Middle East peace, who works with some other foreign countries. He has some projects domestically like prison reform, but he is someone who kind of has a wide portfolio, but a portfolio that's not particularly central to the administration. He's most important to the president because he's a trusted confidant, someone who's part of the family, married to his daughter. And that is his role. That's why he'll continue to be influential. And I think he will, as long as he stays, he'll have that relationship with the president.
A bit of breaking news just a couple hours ago. Your colleague Maggie Haberman at The New York Times broke the story that White House Communications Director Hope Hicks will be leaving the White House in the next few weeks.
Yes.
Hicks was known for shying from the spotlight in a way that strongly broke from past precedent, declining to sit for interviews. What do you believe are behind her reasons for leaving? And do you think it has anything to do with her 8-hour testimony yesterday in front of the House Intelligence Committee?
It's more about exhaustion. It's about she's spent so much time in the last 3 years at candidate Trump and President Trump's side. She was ready to call it quits. She's still, I think, going to be close to the White House based on my reporting this afternoon. Yeah, it's a changing of an era, end of an era in Trump's inner circle. She was the gatekeeper, the media strategist for a media-driven politician. No one in my whole experience with President Trump, other than his own family, has been closer to him in understanding his quirks, his personality, the way he operates. And to have her gone in that inner circle really leaves the president in a different position than he's been for years. He's always relied on her day in, day out, and that's no longer going to be the case. End of an era.
You and Maggie Haberman are both part of a wave of journalists that really rose to prominence in the Trump era. Without diminishing the tremendous journalistic gifts you both clearly possess, Do you believe that the fact that a lot of editors didn't take Trump seriously as a candidate offered a space for a new generation of journalists to shine?
At the end of the day, and I highly respect Maggie Haberman, is that we all just need to do the reporting, and I have a sign on my desk that says assume nothing. Don't make assumptions about politicians. Don't make assumptions that Bernie Sanders is just going to be a gadfly and he'll never go anywhere in a Democratic presidential race. Can't make assumptions about a celebrity billionaire who seems like just a reality TV star. He's not going to go anywhere. And in a turbulent time in America, as all this anger is out there in the electorate, you can't make assumptions that traditional politicians are only going to dominate. As a reporter, I try to put my assumptions on a shelf and my opinions on a shelf every day and just let the story speak for itself. I got to run now, but I really appreciate this.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Robert.
Thank you.
And thank you so much for taking over the helm of Gwen Ifill and really keeping the
show. So much, and I appreciate all your hard work. I love your program, so thanks for having me on.
Thank you very much. That was Robert Costa, the host of Washington Week on PBS and a national political reporter for The Washington Post. You're listening to Trump Watch on WBAI New York. I'm Jesse Lent. That's going to do it for this week's show. Reggie Johnson engineered this program live. Special thanks to Brooke Lorenz at The Washington Post. And you can hear all 59 episodes of Trump Watch with Jesse Lent at soundcloud.com/TrumpWatchWBAI or wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is TrumpWatchWBAI. And I'll be back next Wednesday at 6:30 p.m. when we'll break down another aspect of the Donald Trump administration. Until then, I'm your host, Jesse Lent. Talk to you next time. We're gonna pick up everyone. Come on, take me by my hand. Gonna bury all our troubles in the sand. Oh yeah. Can't you see the wonder at your feet? Your life's complete. Follow me down. Can't you see me growing? Get your guns. The time has come to follow me down. Follow me across the sea where milky babies seem to be molded, flowing revelry with the one that set them free. Tell all the people that you